I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Hello and welcome back to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Miyako Vassar. I'm happy to be hosting you all today and to be here to talk to my peers, Aaron Wang, Tegan Marshall, and Michael Robert Kaditz, as we discuss the second part of the show I did previously on meta-ethics. We often like to ask ourselves the question of how we should act, which would be what we call normative ethics, so answering questions like, for example, if you're a utilitarian, maximize pleasure and minimize pain. Or if you're a contractarian, just follow the social contract. That's how we should act. But meta-ethics asks the question of what is the nature of our ethical claims? Where do those claims come from? Do they really exist out in the world, or is it just something that is dependent on our minds? And what is the structure that sort of holds them together and by which we can say that these claims exist in the first place? And then after that comes the idea of making the claims themselves, how we should act. I think that today, for the benefit of my interlocutors here, as well as for the audience, I think I'll just start by inviting a question or somehow opening up the discussion on something that we talked about last day, and then we'll see where the conversation takes us. So whoever would like to jump in with a question or a thought that remained from part one, feel free.
Okay, I'm jumping in, seeing as you gave the invitation, because I've been waiting weeks to have this conversation. Last show, we talked about the possibility of different cultures' ethical and moral standards being set and understood within the framework of historical knowledge. That for that culture and within that context, that belief seemed completely justified, and therefore, in that particular group's morality, it makes sense. We had a context. We had a conversation about a real example of what do we do in certain cultures, certain societies that believed it was necessary to offer a sacrifice for the sun to rise the next day. That led to the conversation of, or the question which I'm posing now in that context, is I struggle to see any instance, even in a subjective sense, where any human being should be comfortable with the idea of a human sacrifice being part of a cultural morality and ethic.
What I want to clarify about that is that it is totally possible, if you follow the standard view of psychology, which I'll repeat for the sake of our audience in just a moment, it is totally possible for you to have a belief that is wrong because it is based on factually incorrect information. So let me backtrack a little bit. So standard view of psychology, once again, popularized by Hume, though he wasn't the first to necessarily propose it. It says that basically there are two kinds of knowledge, in a sense. So there's facts and there are beliefs or values. Facts describe the world the way it is right now. Values are just how the world ought to be, what we think should be the case. And they are completely independent and separate, such that a fact only describes the world but can't tell you what to do necessarily, and values tell you how you feel or what you would like to do, but they don't describe anything real right now. So if you have a belief that to sacrifice someone in order for the sun to rise, or you have a belief that that is the case, the fact underlying that belief that the sacrifice is what allows the sun to rise is erroneous. By definition, by coexistence, the value, the desire that you have that people ought to sacrifice such that the sun should rise is wrong, or it's founded on a wrong factual statement. The reason I brought up that example is because it illustrates that people such as relativists or subjectivists will make the claim that these ethical judgments that we have, how we should act, their nature is dependent on the mind and is dependent on context. So again, a subjectivist will tell you, dependent on time, on history, on you know, who each individual is, ethical judgments will change, or their nature is simply based on contingent matters. A realist, of course, will tell you the opposite, that there are facts about the world that can't change. But what that goes to show, that people can have different beliefs over history, is that that is something in support of the subjectivist or the relativist argument, even though in this particular case, I will admit that that particular belief could be wrong because it's based on wrong information, but it does serve to illustrate the way a relativist might see it, that it's dependent on context of the situation.
Okay, Mihai, I hear that, but I'm gonna be a good interlocutor and push back on you a little bit. This is not a platonic, oh, Socrates, you're the best, okay, bye. This is a straight on. I understand that, but my question is, for you to make that statement in this context, in the 21st century, that is erroneous to them in that context, at that point, that is not erroneous.
That's not true. So here, let me clarify. If you agree that there are facts about the universe, let's ignore ethical facts for a second, because that's what we're talking about right now, whether or not they're really facts. If you agree that there are physical facts about the universe, which we seem to think that is the case, then you can identify the causes that cause the sun to rise. I say that in air quotes because we're obviously talking about rotation. Now we know in the 21st century. So you know the physical facts that make that phenomenon happen. Whereas in that historical context, they did not. And so it's not the ethical fact that I'm talking about that makes that belief erroneous. It's a physical fact that the sacrifice has anything to do with the sun rising, right? So the belief can be wrong because it's based on what we can really identify as a misjudged fact, or like a something that is not factual, without talking about the ethical claim itself and whether or not that is factual.
I'm wondering if you could say exactly how the example you gave of the sun rising is analogous to ethics. Like, how does that relate to ethics? Because a claim of fact with regards to the physical world is not exactly the same thing as an ethical claim. But yeah.
No, you're right. You're right. So in that sense, I admit that perhaps the example is not best suited for our particular discussion on ethics, because again, it is founded on what they thought was a physical belief about the universe, which, as I have mentioned, is not the case. But if you want me to tie it back to our discussion about meta-ethics, if you're trying, for example, you make a new society and you're trying to determine, should we sacrifice people? Is that a way in which we should act? Forget, you know, erroneous facts about the sun rising, but let's just say, do we think that this should be a society where we sacrifice people? Well, if you're a realist, you would try to explain to me that there is some fact about the universe that tells us that we either should or should not do that. That as incontrovertible as the facts of physics, there is an ethical fact out there that tells us we should sacrifice people or we should not. That's the realist's job. Once again, you can be a realist and believe that some things are contingent, but you must hold the belief that at least some ethical judgments are facts that exist independent of us in the universe. This may be one of them. If you're a relativist, just to clarify, you know, in case our audience wants the reminder, a relativist would say something like, it's not, you can't identify a fact about the universe that's universal that tells us this, though in a particular context, in a specific situation, we could find the right way to act objectively. That just, it just doesn't track across all situations and all time. And a subjectivist goes even further to say it's mind dependent. It depends on the person.
There's quite a distance between a moral realist on one hand and a subjectivist on the other hand. So I would suggest that many of the mainstream ethical theorists that we have learned about and many of us respect, like Immanuel Kant, for example, land somewhere in between. So you wouldn't call Kant a subjectivist, no way. On the other hand, I don't think he was a moral realist. He didn't claim that morality was akin to physical facts or, of the universe. Rather, he arrived at his categorical imperative through rationality, through logic and rationality. And rationality is quite distinct from physical facts about the world.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I have a bit of a different reading on that, which is that it's not that he treated it as if the fact that he uses rationality and logic to arrive at his ethical conclusions in the first place is an indication that they are something to be found. That is the point, I think, of realism. The way I see it is that they're independent of us. They are out there to be found. So much like at one point you might not know the laws of physics and at some point you do, he believes that if you follow the right logical track, you can, through rationality, through his, various acid tests of, the imperatives, you can find the laundry list of things that we should not do, because he often phrased them negatively, right? Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, whatever. It's like the commandments. That's often how Immanuel Kant is described. So the idea is that for someone like Kant, using the tool of rationality, you arrive at something to be found, these ethical truths. And I think that's where I disagree with the theory of relativism, is that it's not convincing to me that there are actually ethical truths to be found that are universal and do not change over the course of different circumstances or different societies. Because at any point in Kant's model of finding categorical imperatives, you can point out a counterexample, I believe, where it doesn't apply universally, or you can point out a flaw in his system. And I think that's why I sit more on the side of something like relativism, which is in between, but I don't think Kant is in between. I think he's quite strongly a realist.
There's a little bit of a contradiction here, because on one side of things, you can see morality as being what you personally believe to be true and believe to be right or good. And if you see morality from that perspective, from the individual perspective, it's impossible not to see it as a real thing, because everyone has real beliefs about what they think is good or right, even if we don't always act on those beliefs in a logically or rationally consistent manner. Everyone has those intuitions, so morality feels real. Just because morality feels real to individuals does not mean that morality as a social construct is uniform across time and space, that these timeless ethical principles exist. And so that's essentially the conundrum I came to, was that just because is that perhaps there might be a distinction between how we view morality from the societal perspective and how we view morality from the individual perspective. And I think if you view morality from the social perspective, then you have to think about context and culture. And you might think, well, why is that? And the simple reason is because different cultures will approach situations differently. And the easiest, and you could say realist, example of this is laws. If you go around the world and research different legal systems and the basis of different legal systems, you can see that different nations and different countries have different modes by which they create the rules of their society. So, but I mean, that brought me to a very disturbing conclusion, which was, if that is the case, how do we know that the rules of our society are the right rules? Or if there are no, essentially, if there are no perfect rules for society, what is then the purpose of personal morality, if not to create a perfect or a better society? So that's my thinking so far. I don't know if that helps any of you guys along.
Actually, Tegan, I see. Do you want to jump in before I do?
Oh, you bet I do. Okay, so let's get right into it. Aaron brings up an interesting point. How do we know that our societal, let's not call them laws per se, let's call them expectations, which then govern behavior, is correct? Because the only reason they're laws is because they're mutually agreed upon by a large majority of people anyways. So there are social expectations which govern one's behavior. I think the first thing is that, this is me pulling a bit of sociology into here, that, and social contract theory, is that you have a wide range of people in the West, anyway, who ascribe to similar ideals. Dignity of the human person, which entails that they should be safe within their own countries. A desire to have order and freedom from chaos. All these kind of things are mutually agreed upon because those are ingrained, to some sense, in human psyche. The need to both socialize and protect one another. So you can take an evolutionary psychology kind of view and say that those are ingrained behaviors which we communicate externally through the creation of these laws and measures to protect people. In terms of individual impact, individual more subjective aspects of morality, Aaron is also quite right that there is, even within an overarching social aspect, it is one of the challenges, because although we have these overarching standards, our individual experience is going to impact the way we view that. And yeah, go ahead, Mihai.
Yeah, so the reason I wanted to do this show on metaethics is exactly for this reason, because I want to challenge you all as thinkers to distinguish the nature of ethical claims from intuitions on morality. And the reason I say that is because it is very tempting as a conclusion to say, yeah, we have some beliefs that seem to be to tell us what is right and wrong, that they are, whether we are taught them or whether they seem to come more naturally than that, we have some beliefs that some things are right and some are wrong. And that seems to be a pretty powerful motivator for calling those things real or true. But there, you have to be able to offer a story as to why those things are true, or why they should be universal, or why they shouldn't be. And that's the whole point of these different meta-ethical theories. So if you tell me, Aaron, that you have a belief that something is wrong about, you know, that something is, there is something that we shouldn't do as human beings, I'm challenging you to be able to tell me, okay, is that because there is some real identifiable fact about the universe that tells us that that thing is wrong, or is it just because you believe it's wrong? And if it's just because you believe it's wrong, I see no reason to make the leap from your personal belief to universalizing that to a whole group of people. Now, through social contract theory, like you said, Tegan, you might say that that's what we do. We make laws by way of, agreeing, a large group of people agrees on things that we shouldn't do, and we codify those and then create punishment for them. But the laws, again, and ethics, laws and moral judgments are not always the same thing. And that's a big debate for a lot of legal, lawmakers, right? Is It is fundamentally based on some things that we value in the world, like dignity, like safety, like liberty, all these things that you stated. But at the same time, there are laws that have nothing to do with that. And so they're not exactly the same thing, law and morals. And so that's why I'm challenging you to stick to a story, right? Because if you say that, again, it's subjective, it's what's in your own mind, then maybe that's what it is. But then, of course, I'm going to have objections to that personally. But there are people that agree with you. But I think sitting in the gray zone is easier. It feels easier because you can say, yeah, I think this is wrong. And therefore, maybe it is a thing that is wrong universally. But the logic just isn't there.
And just to back up a little bit, there was something Tegan said that I don't really agree with. And that's that in the Western tradition, we have laws based off of mutual agreement. Or the basis of laws is mutual agreement, and that's kind of universalizable across human natures and cultures. And maybe Tegan wasn't going that far, but I want to dive into that a little bit more, because I think you don't have to look very far in history to see examples of society where their laws are not so much about mutual agreement and more just about, you could say, necessity, or it's a small group of individuals telling essentially the rest of society how to behave. And so that's kind of the problem in the Western tradition, is that we want to view every human experience through the lens of our own experience, which means that, you know, we kind of want to say, well, you know, we live in a democratic society, or a society that proclaims itself to be democratic and has a long history of that. I was thinking about which word here to use. I'm going to use the word British. The history of British parliamentary procedure goes, essentially, you could argue, is the defining feature of Western culture. It's the thing that we have, you could say, evolved to be the pinnacle of our civilization, where you find the exact same type of business meeting procedures with motions and order and points of order. These parliamentary procedures, you find them in our businesses, our schools, our legal systems. Everything about how we try to decide things is through that social mechanism. But that doesn't necessarily mean that social mechanism is how human beings are supposed to behave and what is good and legal. Or good and right. And so, yeah, there is a distinction between law and morality. And you could say, for instance, does that mean that other cultures, for instance, let's say if we were in a, I don't know what the basis of French law is, but I would be hard pressed to imagine that they use the exact same rules as British parliamentary procedure and where that's evolved from. I think French law has evolved in a totally different way because it's a different culture.
Yeah. And so, again, that is actually a reason that I subscribe to something like relativism as my meta-ethical claim, because relativism kind of describes ethics as laws or as language, as in they have some analogous features, whereby laws are objective, they exist in the moment, and you have to follow them or else there are repercussions. But we change laws over time, right? Just like, America was created on the basis of some individuals from Britain that, they had some disagreements on the system. They created their own sets of laws. It was like Canada was created again and became independent, changed their laws, and they differ from country to country and everything. Similarly, I think ethics can be described that way, where each situation demands an optimal, correct answer. But that changes depending on the situation, you know? And it's quite possible that in a different situation or a slightly different circumstance with different variables, you would come to the conclusion that something you thought was right is actually wrong. And that's not because you are inconsistent as a person or as a thinker. I think that's because there is actually a change that takes place there. And, you know, not to get too far into the description of British and French law and common law, and I won't get into that, but I do appreciate it anyway, because I think it helps to illustrate my personal position on this.
And yet, I am still unsatisfied. I would like to take a couple steps back and suggest to you, Mihai, you made an interesting statement that you were going to request of us to stick to a story. Stick to a particular origin point. This is where I can bring in a little bit of my thesis topic material to suggest that stories are all that society is based upon. That we as human beings, according to Dr. Jordan Peterson's book, Maps of Meaning, The Architecture of Belief, humans are made for stories. And because stories are culturally specific, we run into the problem you're specifying. But Dr. Peterson also makes the point that this idea, and maybe this plays into your hand a little bit in terms of relativism for metaethics, because of the variety of experience and stories and all those things, we run into the issue of stories are what the basis of our reality is. And Dr. Peterson makes the claim that we anxiously look for one solution, one reason for things as a result of the scientific revolution. What would be your response to that? Do you think he's correct in saying that we anxiously look for objective morality partially because we have all been raised in a time that says science must provide an answer, and we're dealing in a field where science perhaps does not apply, which is why, going back to your sacrifice example, scientifically, we know that's wrong. But philosophically, we would know that's wrong in that context.
I think that makes a pretty interesting claim on behalf of subjectivism, which I'll get into in a moment. However, just before I get into that, I wanted to mention to our audience, remind you that you are listening to The Canadian Philosophy Show, and you can find archives of this show at a new location, no longer Mixcloud, but tcps.podbean.com. So that's The Canadian Philosophy Show, tcps.podbean.com, to find archives of the show. To respond to your claim there, Tegan, that Dr. Peterson's claim, I should say, that we are made for stories or made of stories, and we anxiously look for objective solutions to a realm that doesn't necessarily have objective answers, that makes an interesting and compelling point in favor of the subjectivist idea, that it comes from us, that there is not an objective answer to these questions, and it's a realm that defies explanation. I think the issue with making a claim like that is that functionally it makes ethical discussion pointless. We wouldn't be talking to each other about what we should and shouldn't do if we really believed that it all is from us, it all comes from us, and it's all dependent on us. Because to say then that I think, you know, abortion is wrong, for example, and the person talking to me says abortion is not wrong, the only reason we have that argument is because we really believe that there's a right answer to that question. If we believed in subjectivism, we would just understand that all we were saying was hooray abortion or boo abortion. It's all just an emotive kind of claim. Now, of course, there are some people that take subjectivism a little bit differently. They say it's not just an emotional thing, but it's about thinking things through logically, and the emotions we're left with kind of describe a pseudo correct answer. But anyway, I won't get into that. I don't really think that that's a strong argument in any case. But I think if you're willing to sacrifice the idea that ethical discussion means anything, then sure, support that. But I don't think just because we're storytellers and we don't necessarily have objective answers to everything means that we should jump to the conclusion that this realm doesn't have right answers, at least in certain contexts.
If you claim, or if somebody claims to be a subjectivist, isn't that person then committed to live and let live? In other words, not judging or commenting or trying to influence what other people do. Now, of course, we need to distinguish between cultural subjectivity or